Well, good evening. If you want to go ahead and open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13, we are being ambitious tonight. We're going to cover two entire chapters through this book. And that's what we have been doing on Sunday nights, just kind of going through usually just a chapter of 1 Samuel. It's such a practical book. And kind of where we left off, I guess a couple of weeks ago, before Jason interrupted my series, where we were was basically Saul had kind of confirmed himself as the king. He had a great victory over the Ammonites, who were kind of taking advantage of those in Jabesh Gilead, and everyone wanted to make him king. And Samuel had that final address there in chapter 12, saying, "You did wrong in requesting for a king because God was your king. He has been nothing but good to you, but you still rejected him. But I'm still going to pray for you. I'm still going to help you in any way that I can." And Saul's main enemy, really the main enemy of Israel at this time, kind of the latter part of the Judges on into the kingship of David, are the Philistines. They are just kind of the thorn in Israel's side, and that's who Saul is up against in these two chapters. These two chapters are bookended with a summary of Saul's reign as king. And there's a lot of some question marks there in the first verse of chapter 13. Some versions, like the ESV, says Saul lived for 1 year and then became king, and when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel. And some give that age when Saul was 1 year old, he became king. And you're like, well, how in the world did that happen? Right? I thought he must have been crawling after those donkeys, right, that were lost. How do we reconcile that? Well, in Acts chapter 13, and in verse 21, Saul of Tarsus was preaching a sermon, and he taught that Saul was king, and he reigned for 40 years. Some probably the manuscripts or maybe have the dates wrong, maybe some textual questions there. But basically, what I want to point at is kind of giving a summary of his reign. If you look at the end of chapter 14 in verses 47 to 52, it's basically describing these are Saul's enemies that he has been fighting against in his entire reign. These are his children that he had, and he reigned for 40 years. And so it kind of begins with this is what Saul began as king, and then it kind of wraps his kingship up. At the end of chapter 14, why does it do that, right? Well, that's kind of begging the question, and I think the answer is in the middle of those two verses. Kind of chapter 13 and 14 will describe that the kingship of Saul was supposed to go much longer than just two chapters. But because of the choices that he made in chapters 13 and 14, and the life that he lived in these two chapters, it's as though God is cutting his kingship short. He is still the king of Israel, but in God's mind, he has already selected another king, a man after his own heart. So what we're going to be looking at tonight is how did Saul ruin his kingship so quickly after becoming king? So in the middle of these verses, we show a lot. There's a lot to learn about Saul's character. And I tried to be good in pointing out some things that we needed to learn about Saul that were some good qualities that we saw in him maybe in the beginning. But pretty much from here on out, Saul is doing a good job of teaching us what not to do, how not to behave. So whenever we see Saul acting, we can be good to do the opposite. And really, the opposite of Saul, especially in chapter 14, is his son Jonathan. I don't know if you remember all the way back in our study, and in 1 Samuel chapter 2, there was a stark contrast between Samuel and the two sons of Eli. You remember how it kept going back and forth? They talk about Samuel doing this, and now Hophni and Phinehas was doing that. Well, by the way, Samuel, he was doing this, and it goes back to Hophni. It just kind of goes back and forth, back and forth. I think the reason for that is notice the big contrast between Samuel, the man of God, in contrast to these priests who were supposed to be kind of the leaders of the people. I think maybe that's what's happening here. Here is a contrast between Saul, the king of Israel, who was not being a good king, and then here in contrast was his good son, Jonathan. And so in verses 1 through 4, we kind of notice the beginning, and I'm going to just be trying to be an auctioneer up here without any bids, but just talking really fast. And trying to get through these two chapters. But I'm going to do a lot of summary work. But I want us to get these two chapters tell one big story of Saul's battle with the Philistines. But notice what Saul is doing in verse 2. Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the hill of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan. The rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. And then if you look at chapter 14, and in verse 52, and Saul is kind of doing the very same thing. He is always attaching people to himself. He's always kind of, if I'm going to be out in there, if I'm going to be in danger, I want a lot of people with me to kind of protect me. And so you constantly see Saul depending on other people. And so Saul is fulfilling the warning here that Samuel gave. Remember that Samuel said, when you get a king, this is what he's going to do. He's going to take from you. And that's exactly what we see Saul doing at the very beginning. He takes 3,000 men and he gets 2,000. Well, son, I'll give you 1,000. I'll be generous instead of, I'll give you 1,000. I could have given you 10, but I'll give you 1,000. So verse 3, what is Jonathan doing with his 1,000 instead of 2,000? Well, Jonathan goes and he fights the Philistines. So I'm just going to ask you kind of throughout this story, the question is, who is the king in this story? Well, it may be a better question, who is acting more like a king in this story? And I think again and again we will see the answer is not Saul, but his son Jonathan. And as Jonathan is the one that goes out with his 1,000 men, half as many that his father had, he takes the initiative and goes out and fights the Philistines, and God gives him the victory. But then what do you see Saul doing in verse 4? He's the one that blows the trumpet and say, hey, we've won. So kind of Jonathan does the hard work and Saul announces the great victory with Israel. Say, hey, come follow me. And so he's acting like he's the one in control. And the Philistines get the message. It's like, okay, you can beat us once, but you're not going to beat us twice. Notice what they do in verse 5. They are coming full force after the Israelites. 30,000 chariots. Now, that's hard to kind of picture in my mind. But you think about 30,000 chariots. Kind of overkill. 6,000 horsemen. And then the soldiers are like the sand of the sea. You just can't count them. How many? So you just have this huge Philistine army. It's like, anyone in the Philistine army, I want you here. And so, all right, Israel, you think you're so tough that you can beat us. All right, try again. So most of the Israelites in verses 6 and 7 saying, okay, we give up. We won once. We've kind of proven ourselves. Now we're going to go hide. So you have them hiding, going even past the Jordan in the land of Gilead. And Saul is still in Gilgal. And it's hard to tell. Basically the commentators are just guessing where these cities are. They really don't know. But some guess that Saul is about 10 miles east of where this Philistine massive army is. And the people are following Saul, but they're trembling behind him. So in verses 8 through 14, Saul is told to wait for Samuel for 7 days. And this may be a reference back to 1 Samuel chapter 10 and in verse 8, where Samuel says, I want you to wait the allotted time. So Samuel doesn't come, and the people begin to scatter. So if you kind of put yourself in Saul's position, you're supposed to be the king of the people, the leader of the people. Everyone's looking to you. They're scattering. And what happens to Saul? Samuel's not here. You kind of, in my mind, I see him begin to panic. He's like, oh no, what is Samuel supposed to be here? The people are scattering. And if everyone scatters, that we're really going to be defeated. So Saul says, hey, come and I'll offer the burnt offerings and the peace offering. Now, there's a question about that as well. Is Saul kind of taking the place of the high priest? And is he doing the burnt offerings? Or certainly a possibility is that he is kind of ordering for that to be done. You know, sometimes we say the White House has done this. Well, did the White House do that? Well, no. We understand it's kind of the orders of the man in charge that was doing this. That could be what is happening here. But we see certainly Saul being impatient and trying to fix the problem by himself. And then after everything's done, who shows up? Right on time, well, here comes Samuel. And verse 10 is really puzzling to me. It's as though Saul sees Samuel, and in my mind, Saul knows exactly what he did, and he knows he's guilty. But if I've done something guilty to Sydney here, I'm just going to kind of calm everything. I'm going to run to Sydney. I'm like, Sydney, it's so good to see you. And I'm going to, you know, really the text says, and Saul blessed Samuel. So it's as though, man, everything's great. And, you know, I've kind of saved the day. And so he knew he was guilty, maybe trying to calm Samuel down. But notice Samuel's reaction. Samuel says to Saul, what have you done? There's no beating around the bush with Samuel. Samuel says, hey, yeah, it's good to see you. How are things been? No, it just cuts right to the chase. What have you done? Does Samuel know what Saul has done? Well, of course. I think what Samuel wants Saul to do is admit. I want you to confess that you have messed up. So tell me, Saul, what have you done? And then what does Saul do? Well, Saul does kind of what we do sometimes when someone points the finger at us, when we are guilty. And we do exactly what Adam and Eve did at the very beginning. We start shifting the blame to other people. And he comes up with just a, on the ball, it's amazing how many excuses he comes up with just right off the bat. But notice what he says. He says, well, the people were scattering from me. And then he said, if it's not the people's fault, Samuel, it's actually your fault, too, because you did not come in the appointed number of days. And so, I mean, the people were scattering. You weren't here on time. And then if those two don't work, it's the Philistines' fault. Because, look, the Philistines, they are gathering at Michmash, and we just did not have a lot of time, and they were just going to come and kill us. And so, I just needed to ask the favor of the Lord. Isn't that a good thing, Samuel, to ask the favor of the Lord? Isn't that what we're supposed to do? And so I forced myself, and I offered the burnt offering. And Samuel says, oh, well, that just makes a lot of sense. Saul, I'm sorry I got held up in this town over here. People wanted, you know, my advice, needed to teach them. That's why I'm sorry for being late. No, he says, you have acted foolishly. You have messed up. You have not obeyed the commandment of the Lord. I don't care what your excuses are. You had a choice. You could wait or you could not wait. And the God told you to wait, and you disobeyed the Lord. Therefore, God is going to take away your kingdom, and he's going to give it to a man after his own heart. Now, Samuel kind of leaves us in the dust, and we're kind of questioning, oh, I wonder who that could be, right? Well, we know, of course, it's David, but he just kind of leaves that for the reader to think about. And this is what I conclude on that. So whenever I say that, that's when you start questioning me. What I think is God gave the people a king that they wanted. Someone who was tall. Someone who was handsome. And someone who kind of fit the part. Boy, that's the king. Okay, I gave you what you want. Next time, you get the king that I want. I'm going to select a man after my own heart. And what does Saul say to that? We don't know. The text is silent. If Saul uttered a confession, a reply, we'll look a little bit more, kind of his pattern on that in chapter 15 next week, Lord willing. But in the first part of verse 15, Samuel just gets up and goes to Gilgal. But we still have this war against these massive number of chariots and horsemen and soldiers. And so verses 15 to 22 really describe all the disadvantages that the Israelites had versus the Philistines. Saul had 600 men. The Philistines had 6,000 horsemen, 30,000 chariots, and so many soldiers, you couldn't even count them. The Philistines then divided into three companies, kind of surrounding Saul's tiny army, so there's nowhere for them to flee. And the Israelites had no blacksmiths to make weapons, and then the Philistines kind of had the monopoly on that. And so they could charge whatever they wanted, so they had a great financial advantage. The Israelites' army did not have any swords to fight with, save two. One with Saul and one with Jonathan. So notice with me how Samuel keeps going back and forth. From all these disadvantages, what is going to happen between Saul and Jonathan? Jonathan was the one that kind of started this whole process, right? In the beginning of chapter 13, he was the one with his thousand that won this victory, that kind of got the Philistines mad. They said, okay, great job, Jonathan. Now we're really stuck. Well, notice verse 1. Jonathan crosses over to the Philistine garrison, which is just a body of troops. And what I see in verse 1, that one day Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side. But he did not tell his father. I think he just got tired of waiting around. In Jonathan's mind, we have God on our side. Why are we sitting here waiting and waiting when we have God on our side? Saul's not doing anything. We'll see him kind of sitting under a pomegranate tree in the next few verses. But Jonathan, okay, I'm done. And I'm going to go. Why doesn't Jonathan tell Saul? Or why doesn't Jonathan tell anybody what he's doing? Good question. The answers that I came up with may not be adequate, but what I thought was that you think Saul would allow him to do this? Hey, Dad, I'm going to take me and my armor bearer going to go over to the Philistines, and we're just going to kind of throw up our hands and say, hey, here we are. And I think the Lord's going to be on our side. We're going to have this great victory. You think Saul would let him do that? I don't think so. Given Saul's track record and lack of faith in the Lord. Well, why didn't Jonathan tell just someone, hey, me and the armor bearer are going to go do this? Well, probably word would get to Saul. I'm getting ahead of myself to chapter 17 with David and Goliath. And one question I've always thought about is we have this great man of faith in Jonathan in chapter 14. Why didn't Jonathan fight Goliath? Was he there? I don't know. Text doesn't say. My thought is, if Jonathan said, I'll fight him, his dad would say, nope, back to the end of the line, right? I'm not going to let you lose and, you know, let my son die. What Saul wanted more than anything, and we'll see this throughout the text, what Saul wanted more than anything is for Jonathan to be the next king. But Jonathan gets tired of waiting around. I'm going. But notice what Saul's doing in the meantime. He's sitting under a pomegranate tree, seems to be relaxing when he should be active. He is surrounding himself with 600 men and Ichabod's brother. You remember Ichabod? What a name, right? I don't know if Misty will want, you know, number four. We're having trouble with names of our children. What about Ichabod? You know that means no glory. Oh, I'm just throwing suggestions out. You know, well, we have no glory with Saul and 600 men. So Jonathan doesn't tell anybody. But notice verse 16 to 15 of chapter 14, Jonathan's statement of great faith. And you're going to be hard pressed to find a statement of greater faith in all of the Bible than what Jonathan says here. He says to his armor bearer, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. What a great statement. Notice what he calls these Philistines. Not these really strong, giant soldiers. He calls them the uncircumcised. These are not a part of God's people. And he says, perhaps the Lord will work for us. So he was fully dependent on God's might. And he says, the Lord is not restrained, one version says, to save by many or by few. Jonathan knows numbers don't matter to God. He learned that many times over, right, with Gideon. God kept knocking down the numbers. Even when Israel was outnumbered 4-1 to begin with, then it's like 13-1, and then it's like 150-1, and then God says, yeah, okay, that's good. Those are my kind of odds. So Jonathan took that story and said, so numbers really don't matter with God. God can save with a few or by many. And you think about Joshua and the Israelites conquering the land. You think about Samson or Shamgar, just one person and all the damage that they did. So numbers don't matter. And Jonathan's armor bearer tells Jonathan, okay, I'll follow you. What great faith with Jonathan, but also what great faith in this young man, his armor bearer willing to go with him. And so this is our plan. He's telling his armor, okay, we're going to call out to the Philistines. Now, what's the problem with that? Usually, if you want to attack someone and you're kind of low in numbers, kind of the element of surprise is to your advantage. But right off the bat, Jonathan said, hey, we're here, you know, waving their arms. And then he says, if they say, all right, we see you, come up to us, then they know the Lord has given them into our hands. But if they say, okay, wait down there and we're going to come to you, then we'll just wait and see what happens. But of course, the Philistines see them, recognize them, and they think, oh, finally the Hebrews are kind of giving up. They're coming out of the holes, out of the caves, and so they're you know, raising the white flag. And so they tell Jonathan and the army, well, come on up to us, and Jonathan says, we got him. The Lord has delivered them into our hands, and 20 Philistines are killed. And remember, they only have one sword between the two of them. It says Jonathan killed them, but it also says the armor bearer got involved, and he killed. So I think we see the faith of two men in this story. And then that starts to scare the Philistine. They start to tremble, and then God really makes them tremble and making the earthquake, right? The earth shake. And so now they know, boy, God is on their side. We have seen this God before. We don't want to mess with him. And the whole army chariots included, just started melting away. And that's what Saul, the report gets to Saul in verse 16. Hey, Saul, the Philistine camp is melting away. And Saul, the first thing we need to do is number the people. Who all is here? Let's do a roll call, right? And Jonathan and his armor bearer are the only two missing. And so in verse 18 and 19, notice what Saul does. He starts good, but he doesn't finish the task. So he said, well, let's hear from the word of the Lord. What does God have to say? And it's as though they are going through the process. And then Saul says, bah, you're taking too long. Let's go fight them. It says, let's ask for the Lord, but you're taking too long to answer. Withdraw your hand and let's go fight the Philistines. And then verse 23, the Israelites come out, fight against the Philistines. It says, so the Lord delivered Israel that day and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. Well, Saul is feeling good at this. We beat these mighty Philistines. We were so outnumbered. And so what a good king will do when his soldiers are hard-pressed and not doing very well? I'm going to put a curse on anyone who eats food. That's what a good king does. And then notice what he says there. I think in verse 24, he makes it personal. Instead of giving glory to the Lord, which is what he did in the past, he says, no one's allowed to eat until I have avenged myself on my enemies. We need to send Saul to the eye doctor, right? He's got an eye problem. He keeps saying, this is for me, and this is for my vengeance, and this is my victory. So Jonathan, not knowing about that, tastes some honey and kind of puts his staff there, gets some honey and kind of, whoo, that was really helpful, kind of refreshed. And then someone says, oh no, Jonathan, you had some honey. And Jonathan, yeah, that's wonderful. You see how refreshed I am. Well, yeah, but your dad put a curse on anyone who eats any food. And Jonathan says, man, Dad, this could have been a great victory for the Lord, but you wanted it for yourself, and now there's not going to be any great slaughter of the Philistines because of this foolish oath. Now you have a bunch of tired and very hungry soldiers. And in verses 31 to 35, the Israelites struck down the Philistines that they could, and then they rush upon the spoil. Then they start killing the animals and they eat the animals with the blood. Kind of tells you maybe how hungry they are. But eating animals with the blood was a sin. God said to never eat with the blood. And so they are sinning. And so someone, of course, informs Saul, hey, they're doing what they're not supposed to. And so, I'm the leader. I need to tell them to stop doing that, right? That's what a good leader does. And so he said, y'all are sinning, and let's stop this, and let's do it the right way. And so he gets them to stop sinning. And then Saul says, okay, we still need to kill those Philistines. So let's keep killing the Philistines and get their spoil. But notice what happens at the end of verse 36. Saul has this great plan, but who brings up the priest? Said, well, shouldn't we inquire of the Lord if this is a good idea? And maybe they would say, and actually wait for his answer this time. And Saul, I guess that's what a good leader does. Let's inquire of the Lord. And what seems to be happening here is the use of the Urim and the Thummim. So those were basically two stones that would go in the ephod, or kind of the breastplate of the high priest. And it seems that you would give yes or no questions. And if it's no, it would be the Urim. And if it was yes, it'd be the Thummim or vice versa. That's kind of how the text presents how that worked. Okay, well, we'll bring God here and we'll ask the questions. And they're kind of waiting for an answer and no answer. Well, let's ask God another question. And again, no answer. And Saul figures out, well, if the Lord is not answering, there must be sin in the camp. Something is keeping God from telling us what he wants. And so Saul inquires of the Lord. He doesn't give an answer. And Saul figures out there's sin. And he needs to figure out who it is. And you can just kind of see Saul in a panic and makes a rash decision again. And you kind of hear him, right? I don't care if it's Jonathan who has done this, that he will be put to death. He's just so frustrated because this is kind of ruining his battle, right? His victory for himself. And so Saul separates himself and Jonathan from the people. Say, all right, let the fall, the cast, let's cast lots, and the lot fell, you know, on me or Jonathan or you people. Well, of course, it falls on Saul and Jonathan. I'm sure Saul's surprised. And then it falls then on Jonathan. And Saul asked, Jonathan, what have you done? Now, I would have loved to hear this conversation. Jonathan says, I indeed tasted a little honey. So I have sinned so badly. I actually tasted honey. Sorry, Dad. You just kind of see the ridiculousness, right, of what Jonathan is saying. And he says, here I am. I must die, you know, according to your word, because I actually had some honey that was good for me, that everyone should have been able to have. What's Saul do? In chapter 13, Samuel says, why have you disobeyed the Lord? And he gets all the excuses and says, no, I'm tearing the kingdom. God tearing the kingdom away. No response. Saul again is approached by, this is kind of your fault. What does Saul do? Jonathan, you're right. You need to die. He is always unwilling to admit his fault. And we'll see that even in the next chapter. He doubles down. And then the people say, no, this can't happen. Are you kidding me? Jonathan is the one that saved us. The Lord had this great victory through Jonathan. But notice, the people have been going along with what Saul says every time. Notice verse 36. Saul has this suggestion and the people go right along with it. Then notice verse 40. Saul says, this is what we're going to do. And then people say, yep, okay, sounds good to us. And Saul says, we're going to kill Jonathan. And the people say, no. We'll give you two, but we're not going along with this. This is ridiculous. And then notice verse 45 and what the people say. The people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed or saved Jonathan so that he did not die. And Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines. So the Philistines were able to go home and they are saved because of Saul's terrible leadership. And then, of course, we have that summary of Saul's reign. It's as though this is the end of Saul's reign as king. What do we learn from this? This is a really long story with lots of details. But one thing really rings true for me in this text, as we compare Jonathan and Saul, what does a life look like that does not trust in the Lord? And I think that points to Saul. Well, what does a life look like with someone who does put their trust in the Lord? That, of course, would be Jonathan. Do you notice some contrasts with me? Someone who puts their trust in the Lord not in their own strategies, not in their own wisdom. Lean not on your own wisdom, right? Lean not on your own understanding, but in all ways acknowledge him. Jonathan says, it's not up to me. The Lord, he can win with many people or he can win with two. He can win with 1,000 people as he did in chapter 13, and he can win with two as he did in chapter 14. Someone who puts their trust in the Lord puts their dependence on him to win the battles against Satan. It was Jonathan was the one that led the charge against the Philistines. While Saul was sitting under the pomegranate tree, Jonathan said, I have enough of this. I'm going to go and attack. We have the Lord. What are we waiting on? He's the one that takes charge. And Jonathan was not worried at all with those 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and the soldiers that were giants, especially compared to them. He said, we'll just raise our hands and show them we're here, and no need to worry. Those who trust in the Lord have a peace about them. And I want to think a little bit about Jonathan's armor bearer. It says that he was a young man. My guess is he was younger then than Jonathan. But when Jonathan says, I want you to come with me and we're going to show ourselves to this Philistine army, and he says, I'll go with you. There's something magnetic that draws people to those who don't have any fears, who put their trust in the Lord, who rely upon the Lord. We kind of gravitate towards those people, and that's what we see here. When you show yourself to put your trust in the Lord, there's people that's attractive. So may we be like Jonathan in that. But notice the stark contrast with Saul, someone who is constantly adding people by his side, whether it be 2,000 people or 600 people who probably are not allowed to go home like the rest of them. Saul was constantly putting his trust and his faith in other things. Paul was constantly trying to gather people around him. You end up waiting under the pomegranate tree for things to happen. In chapter 13 and verses 8 and 9, you feel like you have to take care of everything. When it's the seventh day and everyone is scattering around, it's up to you to fix it. When you don't trust in the Lord, in chapter 14 and verses 18 and 19, instead of waiting on the answer of the Lord, you do things in a panic. You desire the glory. Everything is for your own glory. This is my battle for my revenge. And what ends up happening when you live a life like that? As Samuel said to him in chapter 13, the Lord has forsaken you. He has tore away the kingdom from you and given it to someone after his own heart, someone more like your son Jonathan, who puts his trust in me. What do we put our trust in? A lot of people of the world put their trust in all the wrong things. They may put their trust in money, in their retirement. Or they may put their trust in anything of this world. But I tell you, all of those things, we're going to be more like Saul. And we're going to be worried to death. Well, what's the stock market doing? Or what's this doing that's affecting this? And we're just going to live in a panic. And we're just going to be worried to death. Remember what Jesus says about worry? To not to, right? He says, you know the problem with worry? It's a faith problem more than anything else. You don't think God, who takes care of the flowers that are here today and gone tomorrow, takes care of the birds and not going to take care of you? How can worry add anything to your life of value? In fact, it always takes it away. Be more like Jonathan, who, even though he's facing a massive army, says, "Oh, I got the Lord. And with the Lord, we're going to win. We can win." This is a powerful, powerful story. And I hope one that we can think about. Because the applications for this are really endless. And so I challenge you to think about whenever you start to worry, and I would say all of us do, right, to some degree, we worry about something. When we start to do that, I say, I need to remember, let's just cast all our anxieties on the Lord because He cares for you. May we be more like Jonathan and a lot less like Saul in this story. Thank you so much for your good, kind attention and your love for God's word. I'm so much enjoying. I hope you're getting half as much as what I am. And through this study of 1 Samuel, it's such a very practical and helpful book in so many ways. We are certainly not exhausting all of the lessons on Sunday nights and the chapters that we cover. So I encourage you to read over these chapters again and look over, because you'll see so many more lessons than what we've been able to cover tonight. If there's anyone who needs to respond to the gospel, who needs to make their life right with God, any way we can help you, we want to do that as you would come forward and as we sing.
Girl, it's so, why, man.